the rest of the Forsaken priests and get their opinions. We can begin to lay the groundwork for this. The young king brightened somewhat. Yes, that's probably the best way to proceed for now. But lulls in aggression between Alliance and Horde seem to be rare. I had hoped to make the most of... Your Majesty? Anduin turned to see High Priestess Lorena, her normally friendly visage held an expression of concern, and her voice was somber. Anduin went cold inside. What's wrong?
It's Will. I think you'd better come back.
Immediately. Chapter 16. Stormwind. Gen was there to meet Anduin and Lorena as they stepped through the portal. The look in the older man's eyes was like a cold hand around Anduin's heart.
Your Majesty, he began.
Is he?
No, not yet. I'm no healer, but I think it won't be long now.
Anduin shook his head. No, there was still time. The light was with him.
I won't accept that, he said, almost biting off the words as he raced toward the servant's wing.
Anduin!
Gen called after him, but the young king wouldn't listen. Aaron, Bolvar, his father, he'd lost too many he'd cared about. He wasn't going to lose Will. Not today. As was proper for someone with so high a standing in the household, Will had a fairly large room. It was impeccably tidy, like the man himself. There was a washstand with a spotless basin, mirror and shaving supplies, along with a wardrobe, a clothing trunk, and a comfortable chair for reading. A mug of tea and a small bowl of now-cold cooked grain sat on a table next to it. The only reason the bed wasn't perfectly made was that Will was in it. Anduin's heart lurched painfully. Will would never say how old he was, but Anduin knew that he'd tended the young Varian Rin, and he'd hinted that he might even have served Lane Rin, Anduin's grandfather, when he, too, was young. But in Anduin's mind, Will was ageless. He had been old ever since the king could remember, but he'd always had the energy to keep up with his young charge. Now, as Anduin regarded the figure lying in the bed, he felt as though all of Will's years had descended upon him at once. His normally ruddy face was pale, and his high cheekbones that had always made him look distinguished now only emphasized the sunken cheeks. He remembered noticing that Will had been losing weight even before they had traveled to Ironforge. He had thought nothing of it then, but it was as if the weight had simply melted off his tall frame. He looked diminished, smaller, frail. Anduin felt a sudden, shameful flush of guilt.
Will,
he said, and his voice cracked. The old man's eyelids, paper-thin and blue-veined, fluttered open.
Ah,
he said, his voice reedy.
Your Majesty, please forgive me if I don't rise. I told them not to disturb you.
Anduin grabbed the chair and pulled it over to Will's bedside, reaching for the gnarled hand.
Nonsense, he said. I'm glad they did. You'll be fine in just a moment. Will, you've been there for me as long as I can remember, anticipating my wants and needs as if by magic. You've taken care of me all my life. Now let me take care of you.
He took a deep breath and asked for the light. At once his hand grew warm. But to his shock, Will made a soft noise of protest and drew his hand back.
Please, no. That won't be necessary.
Anduin stared at him.
Will, I can heal you. The light is a lovely and beautiful thing. And it loves you, my boy, just as your father did, just as I do. But I think it's time I was on my way.
Anduin's stomach clenched. He knew he couldn't restore the old man's youth, although he did not think that such was beyond the light's power. If such a thing were possible, it was not granted to priests or others who used the light to heal. But Anduin could cure whatever sickness was sucking the life out of his old friend. He could remove aches and pains and stiffness. Will had, albeit with reluctance, permitted him to do similar things in the past. Why was he refusing aid now,
when it counted more than ever before. Please, I need you, Will, Anduin said. It was selfish, but it was true.
No, you don't, Your Majesty,
Will said very gently.
You're all grown up now into a fine young man. You need a valet, not a child servant. I've made a list over there of fellows I can recommend.
Will turned his white head and pointed with an unsteady finger. Sure enough, on the little table, there was a rolled-up scroll lying next to a book. Anduin noticed there was a bookmark inserted three-quarters of the way through. He seized on this and said, But your book, you're not done with your story. Will chuckled, wheezing.
Oh,
he managed.
My story's finished, I'm afraid. And it's been a fine one, if I do say so myself. I've gotten to serve under three kings. Good ones. Fair ones. One who needed a bit of guiding, to be sure. And don't worry, I'm not talking about you, my boy. I've had a purpose, and true love, and just enough danger to make things interesting.
He turned his watery eyes on Anduin.
But I'm tired, dear boy. I'm very, very tired. I've lived long enough, I think. The light's got far better things to do with itself than to heal cranky old men who've lived long, full lives.
No, Anduin thought. No, I don't think it does. Please let me help you, he said, trying one last time. I'm just starting my reign, and I've lost so much. So many.
I've lost everyone,
Will said, almost conversationally. Anduin knew that the elderly man was not upbraiding him, but even so, he felt heat rise in his face.
Your grandparents, your parents, my brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews, all my old friends, and my beloved Elsie. They're all waiting for me. Can't quite see them yet, but I will. It would be a grand thing to move with no aches and pains, I'll admit that. But it's going to be a grander thing to set all these burdens down and be with those I loved.
Anduin couldn't think of anything to say. He wondered what it was that was finally taking Will away. An illness. He could purge it. A weak heart or another failing organ. He could repair it. He could. But had been forbidden to. His eyes stung. Will gently laid a hand on Anduin's arm.
It's all right,
he said.
You are going to be a wonderful king, Anduin Lane Rin. One for the history books.
Anduin covered the hand with his own. He did not call on the light. He would respect the wishes of this good man who had served the royal family his whole life.
I'd be a better one with you making sure my crown sat just right on my head, he said, recalling his trip to Ironforge a few years earlier when Will had taken a good 15 minutes arranging the prince's circlet.
Oh, you'll figure that out, Will said.
Will, Anduin said gently, will you let me ease your pain at least? The old servant, the old friend, nodded, grateful for even this little chance to help. To make at least some feeble attempt to repay Will for all he had done. Anduin asked the light for that, and only that. A soft radiance limned his hand. The illumination traveled quickly to Will's hand, then raced along his body for a few seconds, flaring brightly before it faded.
Oh, yes. That's quite nice,
Will said. He looked better. Not quite so pale. And breathing seemed to come easier to him as his chest rose and fell evenly. But Anduin's own chest was tight with grief. What else can I do? Something to eat, perhaps. I hear the chef has perfected some pastries. Will was as bad as any 6-year-old child when it came to sweets.
No, I don't think so,
Will said.
I think I'm done with that now. Thank you, though, Your Majesty.
Anduin.
his voice broke. I'm just Anduin.
You're good to an old man, Anduin. I shouldn't keep you. Please don't berate yourself for this. Nothing is more natural than what I'll be doing shortly.
I'd like to stay if you'll let me. Will eyed him.
I'd not cause you any more pain than I have to, dear boy.
Anduin shook his head.
No, you won't.
It wasn't a lie. Not quite. Losing Will would be devastating whether Anduin was present or not. But at least if he was here when the old man breathed his last, Anduin would know he had done all he could. He had been denied the chance to be with his father when Varian died. They had embraced when the king left, and their words to each other had been kind. But Varian had fallen alone save for the presence of demons and his killer, and not even his body could be recovered. Will had earned the right to have someone with him at the end. He had earned it 1,000 times over. How about I read you the rest of the book? Anduin said.
That would be very pleasant, Will said. Do you remember that I taught you to read?
Anduin did. The memory made him smile. I used to get upset when you would correct my pronunciation, he recalled.
No, not really. You were a very mild-tempered child. You just got frustrated. There's a difference.
A lump wedged itself in Anduin's throat. He hoped he could read past it. He owed Will that much, at least. All right. We'll read. Let me get you some water. He stepped outside to call for someone and found Gen pacing in the hall.
How is he?
Greymane asked quietly. Anduin couldn't speak and took a moment to compose himself. He's dying, he replied. He won't let me heal him.
He told the same thing to High Priestess Lorena when I called her in to look at him,
Gen said. What? Gen, why didn't you tell me? Gen looked at him levelly.
Would it have made any difference to you?
Anduin sagged. No, he said. I'd have asked him to let me try regardless. Gen reached out and squeezed Anduin's shoulder.
For what it's worth, I'm sorry. And it's his choice. You can't save everyone.
It feels like I can't save anyone, Anduin said.
I know that feeling too, Greymane said.
Anduin thought about what the other king had endured and knew it to be true. Only a few refugees had escaped Gilneas, and it was only through the Night Elves' kindness that they had survived at all. The young king nodded, his heart heavy as lead inside his chest. He took a deep breath. I'm going to read to him for a while. Would you mind having someone bring us water and cups? Gen seemed about to speak, then nodded.
Of course. Would you like someone to stay with you?
No, I'm fine. Well, if there's an emergency, you know where to find me. I think it will be soon. The older man nodded sympathetically.
I'll station someone outside just in case. You're doing a good thing, my boy.
I wish I believed that.
When you're Will's age or mine, you will.
The next few hours slipped by. Will had perked up for a bit and accepted some water, though he wouldn't allow Anduin to fuss too much over him. He listened to the book, which was a history about the dragon aspects, and initially made a comment or two. Then he spoke less and less, and finally, Anduin realized the old man had drifted off to sleep. Or had he? As Anduin leaned forward to make sure Will's chest was still moving, Will's eyes flew open. Anduin realized at once that Will was looking at something the king couldn't see.
Papa,
Will murmured.
Mama.
Anduin put the book down and took the old man's hand. How thin the skin was, how twisted the fingers, like a tree's roots. Yet up until his last few days, Will had completed his duties. Anduin's eyes stung again as he envisioned those hands performing with difficulty things he himself could do so easily. How had he not noticed this? I'm so sorry, Will. I didn't want to see. Then suddenly, Will grew querulous.
But where's my Elsie? You had to have died, dearest. If you'd survived the scourge, you'd have found a way to come to me. Elsie, where are you?
His arm extended, reaching for his phantom wife.
I can't find my way without you.
Anduin's heart was breaking. Gently he called the light and placed his radiant hand on the old man's now clammy brow.
Shh, he said softly. Be at peace. You'll find each other, old friend. You will. When the time is right. But now, rest.
Will blinked rapidly, frowning a little, and when he turned to Anduin, it looked as though he did recognize his charge.
Anduin, you're here too?
Yes, it's me. I'm here. I won't leave you.
Will settled back down, closing his eyes.
You were such a good boy. It was a joy taking care of...
He broke off in mid-sentence. Anduin bit his lower lip. Then the old man rallied.
Tell her. I always loved only her. My little Elsie with the fire-red hair. If you see her, tell her I'll wait for her.
Tears stung the king's eyes.
Of course I'll tell her. I promise.
He swallowed hard.
You go on now. I think I will. It's really quite beautiful.
Will sighed.
Thank you for not keeping me.
Anduin started to say something, but then closed his mouth. He could feel the old man's pulse slowing, slowing. Heard a soft sigh from the bed. Slow, slow, stop. Chapter 17. Stormwind. Gen was waiting for Anduin outside the door. When the king emerged, Gen looked at him with eyes that held far too many sorrows. I'm all right, Anduin said. It wasn't quite true, but he had a purpose now, and that helped. I need you to do something for me.
Of course. What do you need, my boy?
Please ask High Priestess Lorena to prepare Will's body for burial, with all rights due to so close a friend of the Rin family. Then tell my advisors to meet me in the map room within 2 hours. Notify High Exarch Turalyon and Illyria Windrunner that I desire their attendance as well. Yen's bushy eyebrows rose at that, but he stopped just short of asking why. Instead, he said,
You don't need to do anything just yet, you know. Your head
is clear, Anduin replied. But I thank you for your concern. I'll be in my quarters preparing for the meeting. He turned and strode off before Gen could continue to press him. He had been alone with Will's body and his own pain for an hour before emerging, and the first wave of grief had crested and receded. Now, he needed to focus. Anduin spent the hours before the meeting writing furiously and consulting various tomes, then said a quick prayer to calm himself, and went to meet his advisors in the map room. Everyone he had requested was there. Gen Greymane, Matthias Shaw, Catherine Rogers, Illyria Windrunner, and Turalyon. Even Velen had traveled from the Exodar to be present. When Anduin informed them of his plans, only Velen stood with him. Rogers, of course, was no surprise. Have you been to South Shore recently? She snapped rhetorically. The very creature you're negotiating with deliberately unleashed the blight against an Alliance town. I had friends, family there. Now there's only Forsaken. The Forsaken are not the Scourge, Anduin reminded her. Some of them retain a sense of who they were, and they miss their living relatives. I can't believe them capable of such things, Catherine retorted. Anduin turned to Shaw. Spymaster? He asked calmly. Shaw nodded. His Majesty is correct. A short while ago, he asked me to send extra agents to the Undercity. A governing body has sprung up in Sylvanas' absence. They call themselves the Desolate Council. I have reason to believe that the King's proposal of a gathering would be extremely well received among this number. But they do not represent the majority of the Forsaken. Rogers looked stunned. Anduin took a step toward her, beseeching her. Catherine, your family and friends, they could be among the Council. For a moment, He saw something soft flit across the Sky Admiral's face. Then her jaw tightened, and that face grew harder than he'd ever seen it. "They are dead," she all but spit the words. "Worse than dead. Monsters. How can you possibly imagine I'd want to see them as they are now?"
"Remember, Sky Admiral," Anduin said, his voice still kind. "You speak to your king."
All the color that had fled her face rushed back. She bowed immediately. "My apologies, Your Majesty, if I've given offense. But the shambling wrecks of my loved ones are the last thing I would ever want to see. I'd prefer to remember them as they were. Alive. Healthy. Happy. And human."
"No offense was taken, Admiral," Anduin replied. "And your point is understandable. King Greymane."
"You know my thoughts on Forsaken," Gen growled. His voice was so rough and deep, the older king might as well have been in his worgen form. "I agree with the Admiral. They're monsters. If we care at all for our Forsaken relatives, we should be trying to give them true deaths, not embrace what they've become."
Anduin's heart sunk further with each opinion voiced. "Reunions can often be disappointing," Illyria said bluntly. "You may not know, but recently Verisa and I met with Sylvanas. It did not go well."
"No, I didn't know," Anduin said, strain creeping into his voice. He thought about his words to Valyra. "It seems each passing day reduces the number of people I can rely on.
Perhaps you would care to enlighten me."
"We met only to see what was left of our family ties," she said. "I will tell you more if you wish. But suffice it to say that I would not put my faith in her, Anduin Rin. She has been too long in the darkness, and it has eaten away what is left of the sister I loved so dearly." Her voice was strong, yet it quivered slightly. Despite all that had happened to her, despite her worrisome familiarity with the Void, it was obvious to Anduin that she was still capable of deep love. She was still Illyria, and the failure of the reunion of the three sisters had wounded her. It did not bode well for his plan to convince this group of the power of familial bonds.
"Nor would I trust the rot-riddled brains of the Forsaken to be able to distinguish friend from foe if they came face to face with their erstwhile loved ones," Illyria continued. "I would advise against this path."
"As would I," said Tyrallian, startling Anduin.
More than most, the paladin understood the power of the light and how it could change minds and hearts. He had even befriended and fought alongside a demon who had been infused with the light.
"I ask you as a tactician, do you really wish to risk failure? You could start a war. If even one of the Forsaken snaps and kills an Alliance member..."
"Hell," boomed Gen. "If one of the Alliance members sneezes too loudly, we'd have a war. It's too risky, Your Majesty."
He calmed himself before continuing in a quieter voice.
"Light knows your heart's in the right place. And it's a bigger, more generous heart than mine. But you have to be a good king as well as a good man."
Valyra had said something similar. Anduin knew the truth of the words, yet he also had to be true to himself.
Gen continued, "We have more than enough to keep us occupied and sleepless at night with goblins, Azerite, and a damaged world. Let us not start a conventional war over, what, a total of a few dozen individuals? We gain so little and stand to lose so much."
"We stand to gain peace," came Velen's quiet voice.
"The actions of a few dozen people," and Rogers pronounced the last word in a slightly strangled tone, "don't determine peace."
"No," Anduin said. "Not in that moment, perhaps. But over time, if this goes well..."
"If,"
Greymane emphasized. Anduin shot him a sharp look. "If this goes well," he repeated, adding, "and I believe it will, this could plant a seed. If these few people can find common ground, why not 100, or 1,000, or 10,000, or more?" Aware that negative emotions were running high and threatening to overshadow other factors, he tried appealing to their tactical minds. "Why would Sylvanas openly start a war? She's got much to lose and little to gain. The Horde is preoccupied with the same concerns that face the Alliance. How to recover from the devastating war with the Legion, how to heal Azeroth, and how to keep Azerite from falling into the hands of the opposition. Do you think she wants to fight another open war with all that going on?"
There's always a plan with that Banshee, Gen said. She's always steps ahead of us.
Then let us work out the same steps ourselves. In no scenario does open warfare work to either the advantage of the Horde or that of the Alliance.
That we know of, Illyria said. And there is much none of us knows about Sylvanas and how she thinks.
Is there anyone present who thinks she would wish to see harm come to the Forsaken? Anduin challenged.
There was silence.
The Forsaken are her people, her creations, her children in a way. We've seen mountains of evidence that she is trying to save them, to find means to prolong their existences.
As I've said before, she wants to make more of them by killing us, Gen said. What if she thinks these humans might be amenable to becoming Forsaken themselves? They could be with their loved ones forever that way.
So, she could kill our people, recruit a couple dozen new Forsaken, and immediately enter a war. That's an excellent tactic. Anduin tried, but he couldn't quite keep the sarcasm out of his voice.
Gen fell unhappily silent. Anduin looked at them one by one.
I'm aware that this could backfire. The Forsaken could find themselves envious of the living, which could solidify a moderate attitude into a zealous one. The same could be said of the Alliance side. They might find themselves repulsed by people they once loved and become more determined than ever to destroy the Forsaken. But I believe they deserve the chance to find out. Both the humans and the Forsaken.
The hawks in the group stood with their arms folded and their lips pressed together. It was clear to them that Anduin's mind was made up. Even though they outnumbered him 4-2, Shaw seemed to take no side. They knew this encounter would proceed.
Gen tried one final time.
I think the others need to know what I do, he said, not unkindly. That you lost your oldest friend just a few hours ago. You told me Will wanted to see his wife, who died at Lordaeron. You're doing this for him, and I understand why you want to, but you can't put innocent lives at risk just to make yourself feel better.
You're partially right, Gen, Anduin said quietly. I would be lying if I told you that I don't wish with all my heart that Will and Elsie had been able to see each other again. It's too late for Will, but it's not too late for others. He placed his hands on the map table and leaned forward. If Sylvanas responds with terms that are acceptable to me, terms I believe will adequately protect Stormwind citizens, this meeting will take place. I expect all of you to accept that and turn your attention to following my orders to ensure that everything goes according to plan. Do I make myself clear?
Nods and a few murmured, "Yes, your majesties," went around the table.
Good. Now let's start our preparation.
Chapter 18. Tenaris. Saffronetta Flivers awoke to pain. The gnome was bruised and battered, and her hands and feet were securely tied. She flexed them, noting that she still had good circulation, and began to assess her current situation. It wasn't promising. She was lying face down across something warm, and she could feel muscles tensing and contracting beneath her, and hear the slow flap of wings. Griffin? No, feathered wings sounded different when they beat.
Wyvern.
She had known her team would be targeted. That was why they had beefed up the security. Safi felt an awful pang for her friends and for the sentinels who had been assigned to help them. That an attack had come was hardly a shock. But why had she been allowed to survive? The Horde, of course, wasn't fond of any of the Alliance races, but they had little use in particular for gnomes. Yet here she was, not just spared, but taken. Kidnapped. She tried to recall the exact words she heard. Kezig. That's a gnome lady. Yeah, and I'm gonna punch the living. Oh, maybe she's not the right one. She fits the description perfectly. You know the rules. Yeah, stupid rules. They had come to kill the Explorers League members and the Protectors. That much was obvious. They hadn't been looking for her, but for someone who looked like her, and they wanted the gnome lady alive. If she could just figure out what they were after, she might be able to bluff her way to safety. And a chance to escape. Safi couldn't feel the comfortably familiar, pleasant weight of her massive tool belt. Obviously, they'd taken that.
It was a shame they'd put ropes on her instead of locked chains, because she was pretty sure they hadn't removed her hairpins. There was nothing she could use as a weapon, and someone had to be sitting near her to make sure the gnome they'd gone to all this effort to abduct wouldn't fall off in mid-flight. Urf. Out there was a thought. Safi stopped even her slight squirming and lay still, thinking furiously. They'd have to land, and they'd have to take her out of the sack in which they'd thrown her. They must want something from her, or whoever they thought she was, but she couldn't imagine... Oh, wait. Yes, she could. She could imagine it all too well. They'd been in Silithus, and they knew there were goblins out in force. Goblin activity meant one of two things, profit or technology. Well, all right, three things, profit, technology, or mining. Well, no, profit, technology, mining, or pummeling people. And goblins also meant... Oh, come on, Safi, she told herself. There are a lot of goblins in the world. The odds of what you're thinking are approximately 5,233,482 to one. Someone would have to know your location, and... Oh, dear. They didn't have to know her location. They were kidnapping every gnome lady they came across who fit the description. The wyvern landed with a thump. Safi started to slide off and couldn't suppress a gasp. Then the bag that encased her was abruptly dragged off the mount, and Safi let out an oof as she was flung onto a bony shoulder. She heard whirring, buzzing, beeping sounds, and muffled conversation in, as expected, goblin, a language she'd picked up long ago, when she had been young and innocent and...
Stupid. Come on, admit it, Safi. Stupid.
She couldn't quite make out most of what they were saying, but she caught enough. Dead. Take her. Better be worth. Know what to do. Her heart sped up. No, it couldn't be. The odds were... She was dropped unceremoniously on the floor.
She better be okay,
came a voice from Safi's past. A voice attached to a goblin she despised with every fiber of her being. A goblin she had hoped to never lay eyes on for the rest of her life. She should stay quiet, not give him any gratification, pretend to cooperate with whatever dastardly, despicable scheme he was plotting. The bag was opened and she blinked, momentarily blinded by the light. Rough hands grabbed her arms and held her down as a knife sawed through her ropes. Then she was hauled to her feet.
Hey, hey, what did you do to her?
Came the loathed voice.
Her face is all...
With a roar of fury stoked by years of simmering resentment, Safi managed to wrest free of the two bruisers on either side and launch herself like a mini rocket, complete with fiery red hair, at her archenemy, the symbol of misery, frustration, and rage. She had the satisfaction of watching his tiny eyes widen in shocked horror and his big knobby hands come up toward his face.
You lying, manipulative, lazy, horrible, no good, filthy wretch!
Safi shouted, her hands, fingers formed into claws, outstretched to scratch his eyes out. Tragically, the bruisers got her just before she was able to scratch 8 perfect furrows in that ugly green face. A rag coated with who knew what foul material was shoved into her mouth, and she was trussed up again. Could she ever learn to get her temper under control? Apparently not. Then again, this was Grizzik. He deserved everything she could throw at him. Just the thought made her squirm with impotent fury.
You change your mind, we'll take care of her,
the biggest, burliest one said.
No need, Druz,
the loathed coward said.
You guys scram. I got this.
Safi continued to squirm as Grizzik showed the bruisers out.
Hello, Safi! Hello, Safi!
He couldn't have. But he had. There it was, the beautiful, exquisite parrot she had created. Oh, if she could just get free for 2 minutes.
I'm sorry they hurt you. They weren't supposed to.
She repeated incredulously, and then launched into a string of beautiful but sadly unintelligible cursing.
Funny thing is, that group wasn't even looking for you. They were after your friends. I'm sorry about that too, kid.
But you're not sorry you had me kidnapped, she tried to say. All that emerged was more muffled noises.
No, I'm not sorry about that. Besides, he said, shaking his head,
those big ugly ears flapping slightly with the motion.
crazy as it sounds, I think by the time this is all over, you're not going to be sorry either.
He winced at her denials this time.
You keep on like that, you're not going to have any voice left.
He paused.
Which, all things considered, might not be a bad idea.
She bit down on the terrible-tasting rag, her eyes shooting daggers at him. After her breathing calmed down a bit, Grizzik came over and untied the gag, keeping his big fingers away from Safi's sharp little teeth. They glared at each other.
Aw, Safi, I gotta say, it's good to see you again. The pleasure is all yours,
Safi snapped.
Miss me? Yes, repeatedly. As you recall, my Lightning Blast 3000 failed every time I took aim. Well, I told you that piece of crap wouldn't work. Aw, honey, I hate you too. Tell you what,
the gnome said.
You untie me, give me food and water and my parrot back, and I'll head out and not report you to the authorities.
Of course she would. In a gadget's end minute she would, assuming there were any authorities, wherever they were.
Can't do that, Pumpkin, he said, shaking his head. And it's not your parrot. It is so my parrot. Nope, we made him together. Come on,
he said, almost looking hurt.
You gotta remember that. It was our first anniversary present to each other.
It had also been their last. Safi didn't want to think how crazy in love she had been with the green mook. Well, she amended, just plain crazy at least.
Besides, just hold on to your hat here for a minute and you'll understand. Your goons took my hat,
she shouted after him as he wandered out. Her beautiful pith helmet, given to her expressly for this mission.
They're not my goons, he said. They'd never have hurt you if they'd been my goons. Or your pals. You know I don't work that way, Pumpkin. Don't call me that.
She strained against the ropes with all the strength in her small body. But the knots were good. Of course the knots were good. We're in Tanaris, by the ocean. Everyone's a sailor, even the goons. She was thirsty, hungry, overheated, sunburned, and exhausted, and she slumped against her bonds.
Here,
Grizzik said almost gently, and took one of the hands that were bound behind her back. Safi twitched angrily, but he pressed something into her palm and closed her fingers over it. She gasped once. The pain on her sunburned, bruised face eased. Her mouth was no longer dry, nor did her stomach rumble for food. She felt alert, strong, sharp. Her gaze fell on the parrot.
There's about 5 different things I can do to improve feathers if you'll just give me an arc light spanner, 3 sets of nuts and bolts, and a good screwdriver,
she announced, and then blinked. How had she known that? Grizzik released her hand. She kept her fist tightly closed around whatever it was he had pressed against her palm. He moved around behind her, sitting in the single chair, watching her reaction.
It's something, ain't it?
He said, his voice soft and filled with reverence.
Yeah,
she breathed, as awestruck as he was. Silence stretched between them. Then finally Safi asked,
What is it? Boss says it's called Azurite, Grizzik said.
Azurite? The very substance she'd been brought into that awful desert to analyze. Now Safi understood why. Her brain was on fire, but calm, not frantic. This stuff was amazing.
Actually, what the boss really calls it is my path to ruling Azeroth with lots of statues to glorious me.
Safi abruptly recalled one of the things he'd said to her while he was shouting and struggled to escape. They're not my goons, he had said, which meant that they were someone else's goons, which meant...
Oh, Grizzik, she said, horrified. Please tell me you aren't working with that ugly green monster with the terrible fashion sense.
She paused.
That could apply to a lot of goblins, actually. What I meant to ask was... I know what you meant,
he said, lowering his head and not meeting her eyes.
Or rather, who you meant. And, yeah. Jaster Gallywicks?
He nodded miserably.
I don't think I've ever been more disappointed in you, and that's saying something. Look, he came to me with this stuff. You got a taste of what it can do. He agreed to let me decide what I do, what I make, and most importantly, how it's used. And he's given me everything I've asked for supply-wise in order to understand it, refine it, and make amazing, fantastical inventions with it. Everything, huh? I guess that explains why you had me kidnapped. Pumpkin, I...
She shook her head.
No, I get it. I...
She gulped. Swallowing her pride was hard.
I might have done the same. Might have. Probably not. But I might have.
His eyes widened in an expression of gratitude, and his ears drooped ever so slightly with relief.
So, you'll help me? I'll help you. Aw, Pumpkin, we made a hell of a team back when, he said.
She smiled.
Yeah, we did. Too bad we got married and ruined all that. Well, we ain't married now, so I say let's get to work. You have to untie me first. Oh, yeah, right, sure.
He slipped off the chair, reaching for a knife with one hand, and hurried behind her. Her bonds were cut free for the second time that morning. Belatedly, he paused.
You mean it, right? You're not gonna clonk me with something and run off with feathers.
The thought had occurred to her, but Safi didn't volunteer that bit of information. No, she was in this for the long haul. Anything that could do what this Azurite could do was something she wanted a part in developing. What vehicles, what gadgets and trinkets, what contraptions they could create.
No, I won't do that.
She got to her feet as easily as if she hadn't spent far too long in a burlap sack being shunted across a continent.
But I do have one condition. Anything. When we're done, I get feathers.
He winced, then stuck out his hand. She opened up her tiny pink one, seeing the soft golden blue gleam of Azurite. And then it was nestled between their two hands as they shook on it. Chapter 19. The Undercity. Velsinda didn't miss sleep. She had not realized until after her death just how much time had been wasted with her eyes closed and her body still. There was an old saying, plenty of time for sleep in the grave. But she had found the reality to be exactly the opposite. She'd slept far too much when she lived, an entire third of that life. How remarkable. Now that she was a Forsaken, she had done all she could to make the most of what she, with what remained of the incorrigible optimism she'd had in life, firmly viewed as a second chance. She'd been a servant when she died, so of course, when Velsinda awoke as a Forsaken, the first thing she did, as her mind gradually became accustomed to her new reality, was serve. It was what she knew best. She'd been kind and patient with those who had awoken, terrified and disoriented, and had helped to rebury those who had refused Lady Sylvanas' dark gift. Part of her understood the refusal. Who among them hadn't been confused and frightened to awaken to the sight of their own skin decaying? No one with half a brain left, that was who. And of course, some of the poor things didn't have even half a brain. Velsinda seemed to have been one of the fortunate ones, who'd awoken with their minds completely intact, thank you very much, and had firmly resolved to put it to good use. She missed her husband, and upon awakening, she had wanted to seek him out. He had been in Stormwind, and Velsinda had been in Lordaeron visiting family when she died. She had been in the castle when Arthas had returned. She'd hoped to catch a glimpse of the beloved paladin and his triumphant homecoming, but had been stuck working in the kitchens as he marched through a rain of rose petals into the throne room. But she had been well within range of what unfolded immediately after Arthas committed both patricide and regicide with one thrust of an unhallowed sword. Her beloved had been spared that, and she was glad of it. Others told her that attempts to contact him would only lead to heartbreak for them both. He believed her dead, and in the end, Velsinda had decided that it was better that way. He was a good, kind man. He deserved to find a living woman to love. Many other Forsaken, such as her friend and fellow Governor Parqual, seemed to miss their loved ones as much as she did. Others seemed lukewarm, and still others didn't care at all. Some were even... evil. What had happened to her, to them, to have such differing personalities and mindsets? It was one of the mysteries about being Forsaken. She had no memory of her time as a mindless creature, and that was a good thing. As the years unfolded, though, Velsinda grew tired of serving. But her brain was almost as sharp as it had ever been, and Velsinda began to want to learn, to achieve, rather than simply do for others. She directed her genuinely caring nature toward how to take best care of the, unique challenges of being an active, sentient corpse. Injuries, for example.
"Come now," she would say to the wounded. "Forsaken flesh won't heal itself, you know."
Stitching, grafting on new muscle, sinew, and skin, and magical potions were the options open to her people, instead of simply cleaning a wound, bandaging it, and trusting in the body's innate ability to repair itself. Time spent physically mending undead flesh eventually led to a desire to study with the apothecaries. Although Sylvanas put most of them to work on poisons, Velsinda studied ways to keep the Forsaken active and healthy, mentally and physically. She noticed that some of the wounded appeared to be more afraid of dying now than they had been when they lived. As she inspected the fit of a new hand onto the right arm of a blacksmith, an accident with molten steel had made short work of his original one. He had said to her,
"Always makes me nervous to come in here."
"Why is that, dear?"
Velsinda hadn't been terribly old when she had died. A young 60, she had always said.
"I'm far less frightening than Dr. Halsey."
The blacksmith, Tevin Whitfield, had chuckled a raspy, hollow sound.
"That's certainly true. No, I mean when I was alive. I felt immortal. I didn't take care of myself, and I was a bit reckless. Now I am immortal, technically. But because injury is the only thing that can threaten that, I'm suddenly aware of how fragile flesh is."
"Flesh has always been fragile."
She inspected the hand. She'd sewn it on well. She noticed again that it didn't have calluses, nor were the muscles strong. The previous owner of the hand the blacksmith Tevin now wore probably had been some sort of artist or entertainer. She tapped the fleshy palm of the hand gently with her forefinger bones.
"Can you feel that?"
"Yes," he said.
"Excellent," she regarded him levelly. "I must let you know that this hand won't be as strong as you're used to."
"A few weeks of hammering will take care of that."
Velsinda gave him a compassionate look.
"No, dear," she said gently. "It won't. You can't grow muscle anymore."
His face fell. Not literally. His face hadn't decayed much at all. He was, in fact, rather handsome for a Forsaken.
"Come back if you can't use it properly," she said. "We'll see if we can't find a better one for you."
She patted the hand gently.
"You see,"
Tevin had said,
"this is what I'm talking about. In time, we'll just wear ourselves away."
"That's what happens in life, too," Velsinda reminded him briskly. "We can't all be pretty, nigh-immortal things like elves. The proper attitude is that we must accept what we have and be grateful for it. You and I and the others are here. And that's a lovely thing. Nothing lasts forever. And if we die and can't come back, well, we've had a second chance. And that's more than many have had."
Tevin smiled. With his intact face, it was a pleasant expression. Velsinda had no false modesty about her own face, which was somewhat the worse for wear from being a lazy layabout in her grave for so long. She'd been plain even as a living, breathing human. Her husband had always said she was beautiful to him, though, and she believed him. That's what love was, wasn't it? Seeing with the heart and not the eyes, and finding beauty there.
"You're right," the blacksmith said. "I don't think I ever thought about it like that. I chose to receive the gift. I know others didn't. At the time, I thought them fools. But now, I wonder. I know Lady Sylvanas is trying to find ways that we can continue our existence. But what if we weren't meant to?"
He gestured to his fine new non-calloused hand.
"How much should we do? How far should we go? Just to keep existing?"
Velsinda had smiled.
"Goodness. For a blacksmith, your thoughts are quite philosophical."
"Maybe it's my new hand."
Tevin had been the first with whom Velsinda had conducted such discussion, but he would not be the last. Once the idea had come into her head, Belcinda found she couldn't stop thinking about it. Now, months after that conversation, the leader of the Desolate Council stood in the throne room of the Undercity, in the spot where Sylvanas Windrunner had stood for so long until she had left to lead the Horde. Beside Velsinda on the top dais were the other four leading members of the Governing Council, who were called simply and logically the Governors. On the second step, just below them, were the seven known as the Ministers, who would implement the policies the Governors created. At the bottom were those who Velsinda thought were actually the most important members of the Council, the 10 Listeners. Every day they would meet and speak with those among the Forsaken who had questions, comments, or complaints about how the leadership governed. They reported directly to the governors. Although any citizen of the Undercity was free to flag down any member of the council, including the Prime Governor Velsinda herself, the listeners were more readily available. Thus far, things seemed to be going swimmingly. Velsinda looked out over the calm crowd that filled the room to overflowing and continued outside. She was so very pleased. Today, more than ever, they needed to stand together, work together for the betterment of everyone until their Dark Lady returned. Today they were holding a service for those Forsaken who had experienced their last death, fighting against the terrifying evil of the Burning Legion. Velsinda had spoken with the Dark Lady's champion, Nathanos Blightcaller, on his recent visit to the Undercity, and had implored him to persuade Sylvanas to return.
"I know she has many responsibilities," she had told him. "But surely she can spend a few hours with us. Please tell her to come for the ceremony we will be holding for those who willingly accepted death on behalf of the Horde. She doesn't have to stay long if her duties call her, but it would mean so much."
Nathanos had said he would carry the message, but there had been no sign that Sylvanas would come. She waited a few moments longer just in case. The Forsaken in the crowd waited patiently, as they always did. Finally, their leader sighed.
"I suppose you all want me to speak," Velsinda said, "so I'll try to say a little something. Forgive me if I clear my throat a few times. We're all too familiar with that tickling of the ichor."
That brought some laughter, raspy and guttural. Velsinda continued,
"I want to first acknowledge our friends who made the journey to be here today. I see blood elves, and trolls, and orcs, and even a few goblins in Pendaren. Thank you for standing with us to honor those who fell from among our dwindling numbers. I'm particularly grateful for all the Tauren out there. If not for you, we might all be extinct."
There were representatives of all the Horde races there, but she saw more Tauren than any other. It was thanks to the Tauren that the Forsaken had been admitted into the Horde. Velsinda shuddered to think about what would have happened to her people without that protection.
"Even so, with the exception of our kind friends who stand here with us, I fear it is, sadly, accurate to say that many of the living still don't accept us. And these individuals seem to think that because we've already been dead, we don't really care about life, or whatever you choose to call our existence. They seem to think that we should suffer less when those of our numbers perish. Well, they're flat out wrong. We do care. We do grieve. Our queen is hunting for a way to increase our numbers by bringing back the fallen from the dead, making more Forsaken. But what those of us assembled here today really wish from her is to know that she values the Forsaken she already has. Not just us as her people, which we of course are, but as individuals. To accept that some of us are content with just a second chance and might not want a third or a fourth, but the last death instead. We stand here today, thinking of those who did experience their last deaths. They are gone, utterly. Their blood doesn't flow in the veins of their children and on to generations, at least not generations who will ever live here and interact with us. Those Forsaken are lost, but they are also at peace, reunited at last with those they loved in life. Let us honor their loss by never forgetting their names, who they were, what they did."
Velsinda steeled herself.
"I'll go first. On this day, I remember Tevin Whitfield. He was a blacksmith,
and he once told me that he was more afraid of death as a Forsaken than he had been as a living man. And yet, when he was asked to serve, he did so. He made weapons that enabled others to fight the foe. He mended armor when it was damaged, as we mend bodies when they are damaged. He faced his greatest fear and lost that gamble. I'll remember you always, Tevin. You were a good friend.
She nodded to Parqual Fentalis, who stood beside her. He cleared his throat and began to speak of a woman who had been a warrior in life and in her undeath until her body had been hacked to pieces by a fell reaver. The remembrances spread out like ripples from a pond. First from those who stood on the dais, then the ministers, and then the listeners. Then one by one, members of the crowd too began to speak. So many of them had lost their families on that long ago awful day when Arthas had returned, that it was rare to see an intact one. Most Forsaken had made new families, unions made with those whom they had never known in life, but who were just as important. As Velsinda listened, holding her friend Tevin in her thoughts, she was sad, but she was content. All mourned, but no one wept. No one railed against injustice. But more important to her was that no one was angry. She had come to believe that anger wasn't good for the Forsaken. Many already weren't thinking too clearly, with their brains usually being rotten to some degree or other. As far as Velsinda was concerned, rage just muddied the waters until no one could see where he or she was trying to swim. There were some in the Undercity who resented the role the Desolate Council had created for itself, but Velsinda had been firm that it was only a stopgap measure. Supplies needed to be brought in. Replacement limbs had to be attached.
"Gracious," Velsinda had said once at a public meeting, "if our dear Sylvanas should step through that door, I'd be more than happy to say, 'Hello, Dark Lady, we've missed you terribly. Please do take over running this great city. It's a very wearying thing.'"
As a servant, she had prepared meals, tended the sick, scrubbed bathtubs and emptied chamber pots. She'd done what needed doing. And as far as she was concerned, she'd much rather step back and let others who were better at leadership step up. She couldn't recall the last time she'd just sat and enjoyed watching the calming flow of the green canals. She returned to the present, chiding herself for wool gathering. When the last person had finished talking, she looked at the gathered crowd.
"My, I'm so proud of all of you, and of those who gave all they had for the Horde. Thank you for coming."
And that was it. The crowd dispersed, and she watched them go. She was disappointed that Sylvanas hadn't accepted the invitation to attend, but it was not unexpected.
"Prime Governor Velsinda,"
came a calm voice. She turned, surprised and delighted.
"Why, Champion Blightcaller," she said. "How good of you to come. I don't suppose..."
He shook his head.
"No. Our queen has urgent business to attend to. But," he added, "she has sent me to learn more about what is happening in her absence, and to let you know that she does intend to visit shortly. She regrets that she was unable to be here today."
"Oh, that is so kind of her. I'm pleased to hear that," she patted his arm. "I'm old enough to read between the lines, young man. Lady Sylvanas is afraid she has another putris on her hands. But don't fret. We're just a group of concerned citizens, caretakers of a sort, minding the house while the mistress is gone. Why don't you come around for a visit this afternoon? We'll be happy to discuss what we're trying to do. Perhaps you would care for some tea?"
Velsinda liked to brew tea, to smell it, to hold the warm cup in her hands, even if she did not drink the beverage. He looked slightly baffled and opened his mouth to reply. But before he could do so, Velsinda heard another voice.
"Ah, precisely the fellow I've come here to meet. Well, not quite, but close enough."
Velsinda and Nathanos both turned to see a rather short Forsaken dressed in priest's robes. She didn't recognize him, but that wasn't surprising. The Undercity wasn't vast, but there were still a lot of people here, not to mention all those who were simply passing through.
"I've not had the pleasure," she said.
The newcomer bowed.
"Archbishop Alonsus Fowl," he said.
Velsinda was surprised. It had been a well-known name not so long ago. She was pleased he had not perished with so many others.
"Oh, my," she said. "It's an honor."
Even Nathanos Blightcaller bowed to the Archbishop.
"Indeed it is. What is it you wish of me, sir?"
"I have a letter. Actually, two. The first one is for your war chief. The second one is for someone named Elsie Benton."
Velsinda swayed slightly. Nathanos caught her arm, looking at her with concern, but she smiled and waved him off.
"It's been a long time since I heard that name. Only my family and closest friends called me that."
The Archbishop's expression softened.
"Then, here, your letters."
He handed each of them a tightly rolled scroll, and Velsinda took hers with a trembling hand. Her eyes flew wide as she saw the wax stamp, which was blue, with the imprint of the Lion of Stormwind. And she knew at once what it was. So did Nathanos.
"This is from the King of Stormwind," he snapped,
his red eyes blazing with anger as he turned to Fowl.
"What are you doing, fraternizing with an enemy of the Horde?"
"But as I am not a member of the Horde, the King is not my enemy," the Archbishop said pleasantly. "I serve the Light. I'm a priest, and so is King Anduin. The letter is for your queen, and it's important. You should make sure that she sees it. But," he added, "it's not immediately dire. I suggest that you do as you had intended. Spend some time here in the Undercity. Take your thoughts and this missive back to the war chief. And you, dear lady,"
Fowl laid a gentle hand on her arm,
"this missive, I am sorry to say, does contain bad news. I'm so very sorry."
Velsinda was glad of the warning as she broke the seal, opened the scroll, and read. "To Elsie Benton. I do not even know if you still exist, but I feel compelled to ask Archbishop Fowl to search for you while he is in the Undercity. If you are reading this, I assume his quest was successful. It is with the deepest sorrow that I must inform you that your husband, Will Benton, passed away peacefully this afternoon. I hope it comforts you to know he did not die alone. I was with him. Will served my father and me devotedly for many years. He did not speak to me of his family. I suspect it was too painful for him to recall those times, and what he thought was your fate. He called out for you before he died, and hoped to see you again. I follow the path of a priest, as you may know, and I pleaded with him to allow me to heal him. He refused, and I respected his wish. I have resolved to do all I can so that those who are forsaken can reunite with their human friends and families, if only briefly. There are some things, I believe, that transcend the politics of kings and queens and generals. Family is one of them. To this end, I have sent a missive to your war chief. I hope she agrees with me. I close by fulfilling a promise asked of me by my friend Will, telling you that he always loved only you, and that he will wait for you. Again, please accept my sincerest condolences." And a signature in an elegant, educated hand, "King Anduin Lane Rin."
"My poor Will,"
Velsinda said, her voice trembling.
"Archbishop, please thank King Anduin for me. I'm grateful my husband didn't die alone. No one should die alone. You tell the king that I think this is a fine plan. I hope our war chief does too. I'd have been so glad to have seen Will one more time."
"What plan?"
Nathanos demanded, looking from Velsinda to Fowl suspiciously.
"This,"
Velsinda said, handing him the scroll. As Nathanos read, Fowl said,
"The outline for the King of Stormwind's proposition is clarified further in the scroll to be given to War Chief Sylvanas. I will be here for a few days, and I am happy to answer any questions you or Velsinda might have."
Looking displeased, Nathanos returned the missive. Clutching the precious scroll, the Prime Governor of the Desolate Council corrected Fowl.
"Elsie,"